the other organizations I'll try to refer to on our website, kboo.fm. Sorry to our last caller that we couldn't squeeze in. Try to call a little bit earlier in the hour next time. Thank you so much, Michael. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Paul.
All right. This has been Wednesday Morning Talk Radio, and this is a song by a group trio from France called Greenwashing. This is KBOO Portland.
On cache les galets sous le sable, on veut des plages de sable blanc, du réseau pour nos portables, on voudrait quatre bars tout le temps, des orgies raisonnables, des grands échangeurs de béton et des amis toujours joignables.
On veut des baleines et du thon,
on veut du green washing.
C'est pour les as, les Pinocchio du marketing.
On veut du green washing.
On veut de l'eau toujours qui coule et des rides un peu moins creusées.
On veut de la jeunesse en poudre et puis de la neige en été.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for qualified candidates to fill two vacant board seats. The KBOO Board of Directors invites qualified KBOO members who are interested in becoming a board member to submit a candidate statement no longer than 500 words, which should include the applicant's experience, information about previous board or coalition experience, and why they want to serve on the KBOO Board of Directors. Please email your candidate statement to Timothy Welp at kboocommunity@gmail.com by March 13, 2015. Candidates should also plan on being present at the March 23rd, 6 p.m. KBOO Board of Directors meeting to present a short statement about why they are interested in joining the KBOO Board of Directors. Again, KBOO is looking for qualified candidates to serve on the Board of Directors. Application due March 13th and public presentations will be made March 23rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm/boardvacancies2015.
International Women's Day.
On this wonderful International Women's Day.
And International Women's Day.
You're listening to International Women's Day here at KBOO.
International Women's Day. This Sunday, March 8th, 24 hours of all women's programming right here on KBOO Portland.
Good morning. The time is 9:02. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you in the next few hours on KBOO. First, on Political Perspectives, Kathleen Stevenson speaks with Shane Harris about his new book, At War, which focuses on the new alliance between military and tech and finance companies, which he calls the mushrooming military internet complex. At 10 o'clock, we hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with host Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, stay tuned for the Bike Show. Today, the show celebrates spring. Highlights are the annual spring fling and the best advice on how to get your bike rolling and how to keep it that way while inspiring others. And as always, thanks to all you KBOO members out there for your continued support. We could always use more of you listeners joining our ranks. Just go to kboo.fm on the web and click where it says Donate Today. Thanks for doing that. And now we're going to go right to Political Perspectives with your host, Kathleen Stevenson.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO Radio. I'm speaking with Shane Harris, a senior intelligence and national security correspondent for the Daily Beast and an ASU Future of War Fellow at the New America Foundation. He is the author of two books, At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex, that's what we're going to be talking about today, and The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State, which won the New York Public Library's Helen Bernstein Book Award for Excellence in Journalism. Shane Harris, thanks for being with us on KBOO Radio.
Good to be here. Thank you.
At War is described by James Risen as an unsparing look at what the NSA and other agencies are really doing with all our data. Basically, you lay out how the internet military complex has developed very recently and how government and corporations are working together in an uneasy alliance. Can you talk a little bit about how the book came to be?
Sure. Well, I've been covering intelligence and national security issues, and particularly where they intersect with, I guess, what you might broadly call the world of information technology, really since the 9/11 attacks. And one of the first things I started noticing after 9/11 was that you saw a lot of technology companies coming to government agencies, particularly in the intelligence community, and saying, it appears that you all have an information problem, namely that you're collecting lots and lots of information about terrorists and people overseas who are trying to plot attacks against the United States, but you're not collecting the right data and you're not collaborating with each other. And what kind of emerged in those first days and, you know, months really after 9/11 was a kind of alliance between the intelligence community and large technology companies and telecommunications companies in particular to start monitoring and collecting huge amounts of information all over the world, but especially in the United States, and to start trying to collect and collaborate among the different intelligence agencies with that data so that they could try and predict terrorist attacks. The NSA was sort of instrumental in that, the National Security Agency. Well, along the same time, there were also people who were saying, essentially, while we're at it collecting this information for the purposes of stopping terrorist attacks, there's this other threat that has not been addressed, and it's the threat from computer hackers and people who are trying to break into computer networks in the United States and steal information, steal secrets, and cause damage even to infrastructure that is controlled by computers that run over the internet. And so this kind of merging of the high-tech industry with the government intelligence agencies for the purposes of collecting information about terrorists also started becoming very interested in collecting information about hackers and digital threats. And so as I've been sort of chronicling this over the years, I've been thinking that it was probably a good subject for a book. And the first book, The Watchers, was really about the terrorism part of it. And then At War came later and was very much about the hackers, the cybersecurity component of that.
You described the rise of a fellow named Bob Stasio, who was stationed pretty near here at Fort Lewis, Washington in 2004. Can you talk about how he became important in the first cyber war?
Sure. Well, Bob was a young lieutenant in the Army. And when he got into the service after he left college, he got into what's called signals intelligence. He had a background in mathematics and in physics. And signals intelligence is really the collection of communications, whether they be a radio signal, a telephone transmission, an email, a data packet that goes over the internet. And as he got into this and preparing to deploy to Iraq, it became clear to him that the enemy that he was going to be facing in Iraq was a networked adversary. And what we mean by that is the insurgency in Iraq was not a sort of hierarchically controlled army. It was clusters of people who were sort of decentralized and not necessarily they were not announcing their intentions, and they were making their plans kind of, you know, covertly. And what he realized was that there was a way to try and understand the way these networks of insurgents and suicide bombers were operating by trying to track their communications. And being a signals intelligence guy, he started applying that kind of mindset to it. And when he got to Iraq, what he started doing, along with a lot of other people who were in the signals intelligence sort of, you know, business, if you like, was to start collecting or taking data that was being collected by the National Security Agency about the phone records and the phone calling patterns in Iraq, and was able to use that to start mapping out who the important people were in these networks of bombers and financiers for the insurgency. And Bob was sort of like one person among many that was an example of how the military, working in conjunction with the intelligence community, was able to take all of this data, this electronic data in cyberspace, and actually use it to some kind of physical outcome, namely tracking down and capturing, or in some cases killing, insurgents. And in the book, I sort of use him as somebody who to tell the story of what this new kind of cyber war looks like in reality, the way that the military is actually using cyber techniques and data analysis and big data to actually go out there and help it fight wars offline.
Yeah, and maybe elaborate on that a little bit, just what the term cyber war means and cyber warriors means.
Right. Well, cyber war, as I define it, is there's a sort of a spectrum of actions that can occur. When we say cyberspace, what we're really talking about here is, generally speaking, it's the internet and things connected to the internet. So it can take the form of espionage, where one nation or even, you know, an independent hacker breaks into the computers of a government agency or a company in order to monitor what people are doing, to steal information. We saw that in some ways with the Sony hack, where North Korean hackers got in to those that company's computers and manipulated data, stole data, and ultimately erased data on some of the computers. And if you move along the spectrum, when you really get into sort of what you would, I think, what the military would consider cyber warfare, is when hackers are taking actions that have some sort of physical consequence or effect in the real world. So probably the best example that we know of this is the so-called Stuxnet attack, where the United States and Israel designed a piece of malicious software, a computer virus, that was inserted into the computer systems of an Iranian nuclear enrichment facility. And what it did was actually reprogram the computers that were controlling the centrifuges that spun at very high speeds in that facility to process uranium, and cause those centrifuges to spin at a rate that they couldn't be controlled and actually cause them to break. So that was an example of using a virus, a piece of malicious software, to cause something, cause some kind of damage in the physical world. That would sort of be at the other end of the spectrum, where the military would say, now you're talking about cyber warfare. You're taking actions in cyberspace that are having a physical, real world effect. Now, you could debate whether that was an act of war or an act of sabotage, but when something starts causing offline effects via actions you're taking online, that's when you're really getting into the world of cyber warfare.
Right, and that was with, that was against Iran, not Iraq.
Sorry, Iran, yes.
Mm-hmm. And that, so that's not even a country that we associate with being at war with.
That's right, and it made it quite a controversial operation, because if the Iranian government had done that to us, would we consider that an act of war? And would we have sat back and taken it? I sort of doubt it.
You say that the last U.S. troops left Iraq in December of 2011, and it gave birth to a new way of fighting, a combination of NSA intelligence with special operations forces repeated over and over. Can you talk a little bit more about that aspect of things?
Yeah. Sure. The lesson that the military and the intelligence agencies learned in Iraq was that you could fuse these two sort of domains together, and that soldiers in the future were going to be, especially if they were going to be fighting networked adversaries like the insurgencies that they were fighting in Iraq, were going to need information, and very close to real-time information, about who they were fighting, and what they were doing and how they were moving. Now, that's always been true. Warfare has always depended upon intelligence. But when you're fighting an adversary that is using the sort of global communication space the same way that everyday people are, when you're fighting an insurgency, it becomes even more important to be able to get inside those networks and to be able to understand what the adversary is doing. So the military today actually talks about cyberspace as a fifth domain of warfare, after air, land, sea, and outer space. And they consider the need to be dominant in that space as just as important as it is in the other four. They've set up an organization called U.S. Cyber Command, which is the umbrella organization that fuses together all of the people in the military who are responsible for protecting computer networks, but also conducting cyber warfare, offensive operations, espionage, offensive hacking. And the idea here is that in the future, the hackers, the cyber guys, will not be some sort of ancillary component off to the side, doing small operations or collecting information for their own purposes, but rather they will be integrated, so that they are fighting alongside the infantry, they're fighting alongside the Air Force, the Navy, they're fighting alongside the people who are running the satellites, because the military sees cyberspace as this domain to operate in. And, you know, and with good reason. We're seeing a lot of, United States adversaries taking more and more aggressive actions in cyberspace. The North Korea Sony hack, a couple of years ago, Iran launched a big cyber attack against major bank websites in the United States. So other countries are viewing cyberspace as a place where they can exert leverage, try to gain influence. They view it as a strategic domain, and frankly, one where they can actually stand up to the United States much more than they could in a conventional military setting, where they might be decimated if they got into a land war with us, for instance.
when you read your book, At War, there's a lot being done by many different players with this data that is being mined in, I don't know, millions of different ways.
Yeah, they're, you know, right across, all across the government, you know, you can look at just the vastness of big data today. I mean, there are civilian agencies that collect big data. The Homeland Security Department collects it. The military is using information. The intelligence community is using it. And the power of information to predict crises, to better manage crises, to understand things that are not immediately apparent without the assistance of technology. I mean, this is something that has been applied all over in government, and not just in the warfare context.
I'm speaking with Shane Harris. We're talking about his latest book, At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. You talk about a turning point, I guess, the whole issue of dragnet surveillance. And you said that NSA had it overseas, and critics feared a change in the law that would allow the surveillance to be conducted inside the U.S., and that's what happened. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, what we've seen really is that the NSA has, and they resist the term dragnet because they don't like the connotations of it. But what you have is the National Security Agency for many years has, in fact, been collecting huge amounts of information about Americans and specifically about their communications inside the United States. And this is something that happened after 9/11 and was a remarkable change from the way that that agency had operated for, you know, the 30 years prior to that. NSA is the biggest intelligence agency in the government, and it traditionally it has focused on spying overseas and trying to intercept communications and understand plotting by our foreign adversaries. And after 9/11, what they concluded was that people who were trying to, A, launch plots inside the United States might already be here, so we had to be able to monitor communications in the U.S., and B, much of the world's telecommunications infrastructure actually runs through the United States. So the NSA realized that it could actually tap into networks and systems in the United States and intercept communications that were coming from the other side of the world or between countries that were not the United States. So it really was a sort of a total kind of mind shift after 9/11 from NSA kind of pointing its ears outward and listening beyond the U.S. borders and turning inward and realizing that there was just a huge amount of information and potentially insight to be gained inside the United States.
And what happened when Obama came into office? What was his reaction to the whole world that had developed in this area?
Well, when he was a candidate, he actually was opposed to a very important piece of legislation that was being debated in 2007 and in 2008 to amend surveillance law to allow the government to collect information without individual warrants, to be able to go to companies like a Google or a Yahoo or a phone company and say, give us the following information on this set of emails or this set of phone numbers. Heretofore, the government had needed individual warrants to be able to do that. Obama was opposed to that, but as he got closer to securing the nomination and I think realizing that he was going to become president, he changed his mind on that, and he switched his vote as a senator. So by the time that he comes in, he's actually been briefed on the vast array of threats against the United States, but also the enormous capabilities, the programs, the secret programs, the data mining, the collection, the surveillance authorities that the government has to deal with them. And he really has not turned back from the way that the Bush administration did things. He's made very, very few changes and modifications to surveillance in the United States. And the ones that he made were really only undertaken after Edward Snowden leaked a huge amount of information about what the NSA was doing and arguably sort of forced Obama's hand. But he has become someone who I think it's fair to say has both embraced surveillance, does believe that there's a role for it and that there should be meaningful controls and restrictions on it. We can argue about how meaningful they are. But Obama really was the first internet president. I mean, he's the first person to come into the White House who deeply understands and is comfortable with cyberspace. It didn't have to be explained to him. You know, George Bush famously said he used the Google to look at satellite images of his ranch in Texas that was the extent of his internet usage. But before that, you know, we should note that Bill Clinton only sent one email the entire time he was in the White House. The internet was a nascent space at that time. It was something that very few people were familiar with. So Obama comes in, I think, having just a completely different concept about the internet as both a strategic asset, but also a potentially great liability because of the way it can allow people to steal information, to manipulate, and potentially to cause physical damage.
You write about a speech that he gave in 2014. I think it was in response to request that he rein in the NSA, but but he didn't. He progressed on with his policies, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this was the first, probably the first really major speech that he gave in the wake of the Snowden leaks, where he was set to unveil the changes and modifications he was going to make to the way we do surveillance in this country. And he had just received a report from an independent group of advisors who'd been convened to give him recommendations on what should be changed, what control should be put in place, what authorities should be taken away. And they came back with a very long list, some of them really quite radical from the intelligence community's perspective. And Obama really took almost none of them and punted on some of the very key provisions. He did make some changes to the way the NSA collects phone records in the United States, but by and large, he left most of these things unchanged. And I think from his perspective, that is largely because, A, these programs are legal. They are authorized in law. And I think he also believes that they are effective. And even when we cannot know sometimes how effective they are, Obama is of the mindset that it's important to have these almost as a stopgap, as an insurance policy. It's important to allow the NSA, in his mind, to collect everyone's phone records in case we ever need to know whether or not a terrorist overseas is communicating with someone in the United States. I think it's a defensible position, but it is not one that many people in his traditional camp on the left, and particularly civil libertarians in the Democratic Party, were comfortable with. And I think they've been left feeling very disappointed that he did not make more significant changes after it became clear just how vast and pervasive surveillance had become.
I'm speaking with Shane Harris. We're talking about his latest book, At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. You talk about quite a few groups, subgroups, groups of hackers, groups of cyber warriors, something I really wanted you to talk more about, and that's TOR.
TOR, mm-hmm.
Talk about what it is, what it stands for, and what it allows people to do.
Sure. Well, TOR is an acronym. It actually stands for the Onion Router. And what it is it's a system that was actually developed, oddly enough, with research support from the United States Navy. But what it does is it effectively allows you to go online and become anonymous. It makes it almost impossible for someone to track your location when you are using TOR. And the reason it makes an analogy to an onion is because what it does is it sends your data through layers and layers of servers and sort of transmissions points, if you like, around the world until it becomes essentially impossible to know where you are. Now, that's really important if you are, say, a democracy activist in China and you want to make sure that you can communicate about what the government is doing and post to your blog about things that you're seeing or read foreign media without the fear of being tracked by your government. Your internet address, your internet protocol address that is unique to your computer or your phone, in societies, particularly where you're tracked, can give away your location very easily. It can actually help someone locate you physically. TOR makes sure that that can't happen. And the U.S. government has actually encouraged, through various grants at the State Department and other work with NGOs, has encouraged activists in the Middle East, in Asia, to use TOR as a way of communicating and avoiding surveillance, which is really quite ironic because one of the things we learned from Edward Snowden's revelations was that the National Security Agency has actually gone to great lengths to try and break TOR, to try and figure out how it is that it makes users anonymous so that it can unmask people who are using it. So on the one hand, you have an arm of the government, the State Department, encouraging activists and dissidents to use TOR, And then you have another arm of the same government, the National Security Agency, trying to find out how to break it and weaken it so it can spy on people who are using Tor.
Is that true about the use of encryption, that the U.S. is working both to improve it and make it accessible to certain people, but also to break it?
That is true. And the National Security Agency, again, has both of these missions. It, on the one hand, the NSA, which is at base NSA, in addition to being a signals intelligence agency, we talked about, you know, grabbing communications, it's also a cryptographic agency. It makes codes or encryption, and it breaks codes. It makes codes in order to protect government secrets and information that needs to be encrypted in case it were, if it were ever intercepted, our adversaries could not decipher it and understand it. And codes have been used all throughout warfare. And, you know, if anyone has seen The Imitation Game, the new movie that's out, that's about breaking the Germans' Enigma code. There's a long history of cryptography, and the NSA has really been at the center of it. And this making of codes and breaking of codes is actually a very, you know, opposed kind of mission. So on the one hand, NSA has been found to be involved with groups like the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, which is a standard-setting agency in the government, to develop commercial encryption that banks and that other large corporations or even individual and users can use. And NSA gets involved in the writing of those encryption standards and tests them to make sure that they're safe. It's sort of like getting the Good Housekeeping seal of approval. But on the other hand, we know that they've been doing things that have weakened those encryption algorithms, those same ones that get pushed out and that people are encouraged to use and to employ, and in weakening them in ways that it doesn't advertise, that it doesn't tell people about. So it raises the question of how can you really have these two missions when on the one hand you're trying to encourage encryption and encourage people to use it to protect their data, but then you're also secretly looking for ways to undermine the encryption so that the agency can break it and can read it. The NSA would say, well, don't worry, it's just us breaking it, and we're doing it for good purposes, and we're abiding by the law. But I think it leaves a lot of people, particularly in that cryptology community of technologists, feeling like the NSA is playing a double game. And this has been something that the agency has really suffered from in the past couple of years and has tried to restore its reputation in that world and trying to really convince people that it can, in fact, be a code breaker and a code maker and that those two things are not opposed to each other. But it's having a really hard time making a persuasive case that that's true.
I think you mentioned at some point in the book that it's easy to make the case for things that you're producing in order to defend yourself. And it's harder to make the case for things that you're going to use in a more proactive kind of way, some of these instruments, some of these technologies.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. You know, a good case in point of this was, you know, there was an encryption algorithm a number of years ago that was eventually put out. And we found out from Edward Snowden that the NSA had been involved in building the algorithm, essentially certifying it, but also was aware of flaws in that algorithm that weakened it. And you could make the argument that the NSA needs to know about weaknesses in technology, whether it's encryption or computer software, so that it can, if it ever needs to, break into a piece of technology that's being used in a foreign country. So take a Microsoft operating system, for instance. Microsoft operating systems are used all around the world. Maybe they're used in China. Maybe they're used in Iran. Maybe they're used in North Korea. NSA needs to be able to break into those systems so that it can spy on our adversaries and figure out what they're doing. And when it finds weaknesses in the software that allow them to get in, sort of back doors or sort of cracks in the wall, if you like, there is an offensive component to that. Now, it's also true that if the NSA discovers one of these weaknesses, you could argue that it has an obligation to alert Microsoft and its millions of customers using it that, hey, you might be vulnerable to hackers. You might be vulnerable to spies in other countries. And I think that is probably an easier case to make that our government should be in the business of protecting us and protecting our information than it is to say that our government should be in the business of leaving us vulnerable to bad actors just so that it can have access to this technology. I mean, it's a very difficult conflict, and it's very, very hard to resolve. On the one hand, the government needs to be able to spy and to monitor as part of our national security mission. But when it's doing that and putting other people at risk, how do you balance? What is the trade-off? And who's really making that decision? And right now it's being made by people in a very untransparent way that we don't see, and people who really, I don't think, are held accountable for making that trade-off and balancing it in the right way.
And who would you say those people are?
Principally, they're within the National Security Agency. I mean, the people who are running the agency, the director, is certainly aware of when this trade-off is being made. Since the Snowden revelations, there's also been more involvement by the White House and by staff on the National Security Council to try and get involved and make better decisions about when the NSA should be disclosing weaknesses that could jeopardize people's data versus when it keeps those secrets so that it can use those sort of backdoors for itself. But we really don't have a good sense of how that's going. There's no accounting for how many times they disclose versus how many times they keep the information to themselves. We don't really know the individuals by name who are making this decision. We sort of just more know by position or by what government body. So there's a lot there that is just really still kind of behind a curtain, frankly.
And there's a part of the FBI that works with the NSA. Are they also making these kinds of decisions?
Well, the FBI has a surveillance unit as well. And they're not so much in the business the way that NSA is of systematically going out and researching technology to try and find weaknesses in them. But they are certainly aware of flaws in software that allow them to be exploited and allow them to be the computers to be monitored and this kind of thing. And when it's aware of those weaknesses, you know, it faces the dilemma as well. Should we disclose them or should we not? But the FBI is a criminal investigative agency. They would say, look, our mission is not to go out and make software safe. Our mission is to investigate crimes. NSA is a little bit different. It's kind of asserted that it does have this public defense mission of ensuring that critical information networks in the United States are protected. They don't necessarily legally have that mission, but they've kind of asserted that they do and that they want to be a part of protecting cyberspace. So I think the onus is on them to step up more so even than the FBI, and explain when they're making that trade-off and what's factoring into their decision.
I wanted to ask you about one cyber weapon that you write about, and I don't even know if I'm saying it correctly. Is it called Zero Day or Zero Days?
That's right.
Okay, Zero Day. I think you say it's the most effective cyber weapon. What is it?
That's right. So a Zero Day is a flaw in a piece of software or an operating system. And by a flaw, you know, think of it like a bug, a weakness, something that's wrong in the code that's not supposed to be there, or a crack in the wall. You can think of it if you want a physical analogy. And what makes a zero day is that this flaw has never been discovered by the manufacturer of the software. It's only discovered for the first time by a researcher or by a hacker. And if that person chose to exploit that weakness, to use it to get inside the computer or steal information from the computer or the system, there would be 0 days to defend against it because it is a undefended vulnerability. Well, if you are a spy agency like the NSA, those are really, really valuable pieces of information to have, because if you can exploit that 0 day, your adversary has no chance to defend himself against whatever virus or malicious code you want to introduce to attack that vulnerability. So having a zero-day exploit, which is just a piece of malicious software that takes advantage of the vulnerability, is a very effective cyber weapon. It's kind of like a stealth weapon. The target can't see it coming. So the NSA has a number of contracts in place and programs in place to go out and find these vulnerabilities. And there are hackers all over the world, independent hackers, who go about their day every day looking for zero days. And when they find them, they sell them. And if you have a zero day exploit in a very common operating system, you know, you might fetch a certain price of it, some thousands of dollars. If you found a zero day in a really mission critical system that's only used by government agencies, well, you might be able to command tens of thousands of dollars for that. And this gray market exists where really sophisticated hackers are finding this information and selling it off to people. And we know that the NSA is the single largest purchaser of zero days in that market. So it's sort of going out and finding the zero days and stockpiling them for cyber weapons. And that makes a lot of sense for their offensive mission. But for their defensive mission, you know, it's a little less clear. Again, it's, you know, if it's finding all of these zero-day vulnerabilities in common software that lots of people use, not just the adversaries or the bad guys, shouldn't it be disclosing those too? And that goes back to this conflict that the NSA is dealing with right now.
You mentioned hackers, which, you know, hackers are obviously a theme in the book. You have a chapter about mercenaries. So how do hackers become mercenaries?
Well, a lot of these hackers will sell their services to, you know, whoever's willing to pay for them, frankly. And there are a lot of companies that have started up, including a number overseas, that say that they only cater to law enforcement and government agencies, but really will sell to all kinds of, you know, shady customers. And what they do, some of them, is they manufacture things like spyware. So computer programs that you can insert into a computer or a phone that allows you to eavesdrop or to track the user of that phone. We've seen some software made by companies overseas showing up, for instance, in countries like Bahrain, being found on the phones or the computers of democracy activists. And presumably, the governments bought this technology, whether they bought it from the company directly or through a middleman, we don't know. But they're essentially buying spyware and hacker tools from companies that are in the business solely of making these tools that can be used for very malicious purposes and selling them to the highest bidder. I mean, and you also have got other companies that are not so much in the offense business, but are in the defense business. So companies that will come in after your organization or your company has been hacked or been raided and will come in and show you where they got in, how they did it, and then will help build defenses for you. And in some cases, maybe even try to go out and build your defenses in such a way that if